This is Empower the Spirit with Dr. Douglas Kelly.
Hello and good evening. Welcome to Empower the Spirit. My name is Doug Kelly. It's so good to have you. Today is Sunday, June 12, 2011. Empower the Spirit is a weekly broadcast of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. It's part of our regular church services. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit. And of course, we deal with those types of topics on this show, topics that teach practical life skills, that discuss consciousness and existence. And so this week we're going to be talking about reincarnation. That will be my part. We also have a guest interview, Grant Rubin-Dunst, who is a licensed mental health counselor, will be joining me to discuss transpersonal psychology and counseling. And that's a part of the program that will be especially interesting to those who are doing spiritual counseling or life coaching. And then following this show at the top of the hour is Dr. Vicki Hunter's Psychic Perspective, where you can call in for advice, spiritual counseling, psychic counseling, that sort of thing. So be sure to join us. That's at the top of the next hour, 10 o'clock Eastern. My topic this week is reincarnation, fiction or reality. And I wanted to share some of my research, some of my own thoughts on reincarnation, because obviously it has a direct relationship to consciousness and existence. It has a lot of, well, amazing implications if it's something that's true. Now, if you're listening to this program live and you're in the chat room, you're more than welcome to type in questions. I will take those questions at the end of my presentation here, since I am not good at reading questions and delivering my program, my presentation. So if you have questions, feel free, and I'll get to those when I finish this. Back in 1996, it was late September or early October, right in that part of time, and I met a woman. This woman would become my wife, Tracy, and there was something unique about this meeting with her that I have always found amazing. I felt like I knew her, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I knew her, but yet I didn't know her. And I've long since tried to figure out how can that be. It's never happened with anybody else, not before that time or even after that time. And so the question is, could reincarnation be the answer? Well, I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But let's talk about reincarnation. Reincarnation, or transmigration of the soul, as some call it, is a belief that the soul comes back in another form or as another person, another incarnation after we die. Many religions teach some form of reincarnation, especially Eastern religions, such as Hinduism and Buddhism. And as a result, many people have actually a wide variety of beliefs regarding reincarnation. There's a lot of tweaks to it, rebirth, past lives. The most common belief regarding reincarnation is that we keep coming back until we learn some necessary lessons, or until some purpose is accomplished. Some religions teach that we keep coming back until we grow and evolve, until we can at some point eventually be with God. The strongest evidence for reincarnation seems to be some of these experiences of people, especially children under the age of 6, who remember these vivid details of a past life. Many of these experiences have been verified after the fact, and so it really makes one wonder, could reincarnation be the answer? If reincarnation is true, then it means that babies are essentially born tabula rasa. That means with a blank slate. The incarnating consciousness then inhabits or possesses the body until it dies. And incidentally, some religions such as Hinduism believe that people can come back as animals. There are those who believe that we can come back as even aliens on another world. So a wide variety of beliefs. So the question is reincarnation real? And the answer is, I have no idea, but I am going to discuss some arguments here, some different lines of reasoning that will bear on it. Some would seem to support reincarnation, others would argue against it. And so I've got 6 points here that I want to cover, and then we're going to elaborate a little bit more on some of these vivid experiences that some of these folks have. The first point of reason on the validity of reincarnation is, where did our consciousness originate? Obviously, the question is currently unanswerable, at least in an objective form, and the answer kind of depends on the way you believe. Now, mainstream science takes a materialist view and says that our consciousness simply emerges from the chemistry in the physical brain. In other words, consciousness is a result of a flesh and blood brain, chemical processes. Other people take an idealist view, and they say that everything is consciousness. In fact, everything you see is simply an illusion created by your consciousness. And then there's the third aspect, probably the biggest group. Most people take a dualist view and say that we're both physical and spiritual, the spiritual part being the soul or the consciousness. In other words, a spiritual being having a physical experience. Now, it's this dualist view that allows for concepts like reincarnation to flourish. But the question is, where does consciousness originate? If we could answer that question, of course, we could answer a lot of questions about existence and so forth. Is this human experience the first time our consciousness comes into existence? You know, or when we're born, do we receive this soul, receive this consciousness like an incarnation? Some other questions. Did our consciousness exist prior to being born as a human? And all of these questions relate to that question, where did our consciousness come from? Where did it originate? If we could figure that answer out, then we would know whether reincarnation was true or whether it's not. I can't answer the question, but it is a good question, and it would bear on reincarnation. And so since this question is unanswerable to us at this point, it really does little to prove or disprove reincarnation. A second point is, reincarnation may violate free will. Now, some people believe that we're reincarnated whether we want to be or not. Karma can also come into the picture. I'll talk about that in a few more minutes. We will either suffer or benefit in the next life according to our present life. But either way, we keep coming back until we get it right. Now, if we are reincarnated and if we have to be reincarnated, then of course that would violate the law of free will. But there are some who believe that we have a choice to come back, which would not violate the law of free will. The problem that is, neither of these conclusions really, again, offers any objective support. Neither of them offer any compelling support other than faith. So whether we're forced to come back or whether we have a choice to come back, again, it doesn't prove reincarnation one way or the other. A third point, reincarnation may violate personal responsibility. Now think about this. Some believe, in fact, a lot of Christian religions believe, that when we die, our slate is clean. Our account is zeroed out. The Bible says that death acquits or releases a person's, quote, sins, unquote. Now, if this was the case, where is the accountability for one's actions? I mean, you take somebody like Hitler and his ilk. You know, if death was basically acquitted one of sins, their slate's clean. Where's the accountability for people like these who murdered millions of people, who are responsible for genocide? You know, under this belief where death acquits sins, you know, there is no accountability. It really doesn't matter whether you're a saint or a sinner. Others believe that karma is a way of settling accounts for good or bad behavior, as we talked about just a moment ago. A person who did bad things in one life would suffer in the next life, and vice versa. If you did good things, you would benefit in the next life. What I would like to know is how a man like Hitler could ever account for his crimes against humanity, regardless of how many lives he lived. Regardless of the attempts to reconcile reincarnation with personal responsibility, such as karma, it's difficult to see how reincarnation doesn't violate personal responsibility, at least in a case like Hitler's. So, you know, there are obviously different levels of damage that a person can do, and people like Hitler and Stalin and others, many others, have a lot to account for. A fourth reason on reincarnation, or a fourth argument, it may not make moral sense. Now, this is one that it confuses me. It's not so much that it confuses me as I just have an issue with it. To send somebody back around again in physical form several times without conscious memories of the mistakes made or the good deeds done, in my opinion, is nothing short of a diabolical scheme to undermine a person's ability to grow and evolve. In other words, it's like telling somebody that they kind of pick something up off the ground, but then you bind their hands or their legs together so they can't do it. Now, some people say, well, hey, you know what, we regain those memories when we die, and then we get it. We understand all that we did, and it all comes together, and it makes sense. But, you know, in my opinion, that's just ludicrous. It's ridiculous. Why get knowledge at a time when you can't use it? And even if this were true, it really doesn't matter the next time around, because you won't remember it anyway. You won't remember those lessons to use them to make that life better. Of course, the reincarnation concept can be tweaked in many different ways, but regardless, it still, in my mind, requires an act of faith, because there's simply no objective or compelling support other than unsubstantiated belief. We are who we are, folks, because of the lessons we've learned, because of the mistakes we've made, and the act of learning is directly related to retaining those memories. No memory, no lesson. So that's one thing about reincarnation just never made sense to me. Look, don't tie my hands behind my back. If I'm coming back around, I need to build on those experiences, build on those lessons learned previously. A fifth point that I want to bring out, reincarnation devalues blood relationships. Now, I will admit that this is one that I particularly have an issue with, personally have an issue with, and other people may not feel the same about it, which is fine, no problem. But let me explain what it is. Specifically, if reincarnation's true, then we have all had many fathers, sisters, mothers, brothers, children, and so on. And if this is the case, then everything that makes a relationship with someone such as a father or mother special becomes devalued, because we've had many of them. I mean, it's conceivable that at some previous life, I was my father's father and he was my child. You know, it just, in my opinion, it just devalues the special relationship that I had with my father. You know, special by definition means unique. You know, it's special. This whole concept just doesn't resonate with me, because it just doesn't seem reasonable and rational. If reincarnation is true, of course, then my argument holds no water. But if, on the other hand, reincarnation is merely a concocted religious belief, then my argument that reincarnation devalues special relationships is valid, and it's also a testament to religion's efforts in general to minimize the significance and value of the individual. And that's something I do take exception to. Individuals should not be devalued, dehumanized. Everybody is special. The sixth point that I want to cover, sixth argument, is the accounting for all these souls. Back in 1800, the year 1800, there was about 1 billion people alive on the earth worldwide. Today, it's somewhere around 7 billion. Obviously, there's another 6 billion people on the earth today, a couple hundred years later than there were back in 1800. My question is, where'd they all come from? You know, if we keep reincarnating, what were these additional 6 billion souls doing back in 1800? I mean, there was only 1 billion humans on the planet. If you go forward a little bit, the United Nations predicts that the world population will peak at just under 10 billion by the year 2075. That's another 3 billion than we have right now, and I'd like to know, where are they? What are they doing? Where are they going to come from? Is there some kind of a waiting list, or is there some kind of an order that you have to go in? Of course, this could be resolved if we came back. We didn't necessarily come back to this life or to the Earth. We came back to another planet. Perhaps that's one way of looking at it, but again, there's no evidence for that. Another way of looking at it, I think, is Buddhism, that basically teaches that we're really not individuals, we're just part of a bigger collective. So you think of it like a drop of water going back into the ocean. Plenty of drops of water in the ocean. You take a drop out when you need it. Otherwise, it's part of the universal consciousness. And that's just one thing I don't, again, agree with, is the devaluing of the human being, of the individual. Obviously, there's no real way to answer these questions, but these are some of the philosophical dilemmas that I come to when looking at reincarnation. Now, all of these points having been said, how do we explain some of these amazing experiences that some people seem to have? Well, let's talk about that too. I think there are some alternate explanations. I mean, we've heard stories about birthmarks, birth defects, ailments, illnesses, fears, phobias, and it goes on and on. And they all seem to relate somehow back to a previous life or somebody's previous life. Let's talk about the conscious recall of a past life. There have been a number of these stories, especially with children, that recall a past life with amazing details. One of them, I remember this one in particular, it was over in Great Britain. A young boy, he was 4 or 5 years old and talked about being a pilot, knew the man's name, knew his relatives, and they didn't live far away from these folks. And so, long story short, they investigated it, they found the family, and everything he was saying was true. Well, how can we understand this? How can this be? If reincarnation's not true, then how would we understand such a thing? Well, I have an alternate explanation for that. And I believe that these people, especially young children who are more psychically adept than perhaps others, they might be unconsciously tapping into the Akashic record or the universal consciousness. Now, of course, we don't have a lot of evidence for that either, but it's the same thing that psychics tap into when they're doing readings or when they get knowledge that comes from outside of themselves. Why could not a child or another person be unknowingly tapping into that knowledge, into that Akashic record, into that universal consciousness, and be relating it, especially a child? It could easily be done. Another hypothesis is that the spirit of the deceased person is providing details, especially to a young child. I mean, they have their imaginary friends, and some of those imaginary friends don't seem to be so imaginary at times. But perhaps the ghost is, or the spirit of that person is trying to get a message across, or trying to, you know, take care of some unfinished business, and they use the child or the person as a medium of sorts. Another interesting thing is past life regressions. A lot of people have had past life regressions, and they seem to recall these past lives with a lot of vivid detail. Some of them could even be verified, which again would argue for the possibility of tapping into the Akashic record. But then there's some that may not be verified, and yet they seem to be real. Well, let me give you an alternate explanation. I think this one's super fascinating. I've done past life regressions. I've taken people as a hypnotist. I've done them, and they're fascinating. And one of the things that I learned, I suppose, from hypnotist Dick Sutphen that really fascinated me was the way the mind works. I call it the mind metaphor remediation hypothesis. Now, I know that's a mouthful, but essentially, the mind's language is visual and storytelling and storylines. Think of your dreams. Have you ever had a dream and the dream made a point, a metaphoric point to your life as it was at that moment? Maybe it was due to stress, or yet we're facing some kind of a problem, and your mind created a storyline to explain it or to address it. I think this is what happens a lot with people. And I think that our fears, our phobias, our stresses can manifest in certain ways. I think that they manifest in ailments, in physical illnesses. I, for one, as I've said before, had migraines for 15 years of my life, from about 25 to almost 40, due to cognitive dissonance from the religion that I was in. I couldn't reconcile it. As soon as I left the religion, they were gone. So I was having stress manifesting as a migraine. Many people have different things like that. But what about fears? Well, this is my hypothesis, this mind metaphor remediation hypothesis. if you go in and touch that memory in some way, it loses energy. If you touch it again, it loses more. Sometimes it completely goes away. So here's an example. Suppose somebody is afraid of the water. Now they can't go in the water. You do a past life regression, and it turns out that they recall this past life as somebody in the several hundred years ago who drowned, or who was drowned by somebody else. So they hence have this fear of water. When you touch that, when you go there, when the mind creates that storyline to describe that fear, it loses its energy, and the people are often no longer afraid of those things that they were afraid of. I think it's a fascinating aspect of the mind, and I think that's what happens a lot. The mind can create incredible dreams. The mind is capable of so much. People have written music in their dreams. They have invented things, discovered things all in their dreams. Why not in the same way? Why could past life regressions not be simply a creation of the mind as a way of telling a story using a metaphor? What about birthmarks, birth defects, ailments, or other illnesses? There was a paper published back in 1992, Birthmarks and Birth Defects Corresponding to Wounds on Deceased Persons. It was written by the late Dr. Ian Stevenson, who was a professor of psychiatry and a researcher. He presented some evidence. He relates a case where an Indian youth had several white pigmented birth defects, or birthmarks, I should say, on his chest. And Stevenson claimed that these birthmarks corresponded to shotgun wounds on another person who was deceased. The Indian youth claimed he remembered the life of a man who had been killed with a shotgun fired at close range. Well, while this case is interesting, and other cases like it are interesting, you know, they still fail to provide sufficient evidence to make the leap from coincidence to reincarnation. And I also have another question about this. What came first, the chicken or the egg? In other words, were the birthmarks the result of a past life, or was the boy's past life story the result of having these birthmarks? I don't know the answer to it, but I do have another example. From a past life researcher, his own experience. He says, I injured my low back in a skydiving accident or incident 25 years previous. Over the years, the discomfort and pain I experienced became worse and worse, limiting my activities rather significantly. In early 1996, while with a client in a series of past life therapy sessions, I discovered that I had lived at least three prior lifetimes in which I had been killed by being knifed or speared in the low back. After processing and healing the past life experiences, my back began to heal. While the actual physical damage I did to my back is still present, and I have to exercise some caution when undertaking strenuous activity, I'm now free of the debilitating chronic pain I'd experienced for over 20 years. Again, does this confirm reincarnation? Well, again, no. If you take my hypothesis that when you touch those memories, those fears, those issues in the mind, they go away. And the man admitted that he was hurt in a skydiving accident. You know, it's, again, a lot to go to take that leap from coincidence to reincarnation. The mind metaphor remediation hypothesis could explain the whole thing. There's a lesson, though, from all of this. We need to remain grounded on what we do believe. I am open to reincarnation. I'm not trying to argue against it or for it. I'm just trying to discuss it. I'm open to the concept. I don't necessarily believe it because I just don't think there's enough compelling evidence to support it at this point. But that may change in the future, and I am open to it. There's things like déjà vu, which in French means already seen. And it's not just, well, we've all experienced déjà vu. I mean, it's very, very remarkable. It really grips you. It's very strong. We've had these experiences before. But there are some related conditions that could explain it. Paramnesia, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this next one correctly, jamai vu, I'm not sure if that's correct. But these are conditions that can mimic deja vu type experiences, and a few people do have them. So the point so far is we don't have enough support, but we still have these nagging things that happen. And to go back to my story at the beginning, when I met my wife Tracy for the first time, I had this profound and uncanny impression that I'd met her before. I even asked her, have we met? No, we hadn't. And of course, we couldn't have met prior to that. I mean, I had moved to Florida from the Midwest, and she'd grown up here, and I'd never met her. You know, I just could not shake that feeling that I knew this woman. I knew her, but yet when I looked at her, I knew I hadn't met her before. And that is really something I can't explain. And, of course, she thinks we spent this whole life searching for each other. I felt like I should know her, but I didn't. You know, could it have been that she just reminded me of somebody I had met in the past? Could be, but, you know, pretty strong for that. These nagging questions still remain. And we hope to find some answers someday. You know, if you have a different approach or a different understanding of reincarnation, you feel you have some compelling evidence, I'd love to hear it. I'm always open to it. You can email me at admin@mchschurch.org. I'm going to check the chat room to see if anyone has any particular questions. And I don't see any particular questions. But I do appreciate everybody listening to some of my thoughts on reincarnation. And I'm going to go ahead and transition to our guest. I mentioned at the outset that we have Grant Rubin Dunst with us. He's a licensed mental health counselor. And his topic tonight that we're going to discuss is transpersonal psychology. It's going to be talking about counseling, how it differs from traditional psychology. And this will be, of course, of interest to spiritual counselors and life coaches. Give you a little bit of background on Grant. He's a licensed mental health counselor in Florida. He holds a master's degree in rehabilitation and mental health counseling. He's certified in substance abuse and addictions counseling and holds national certification as a rehabilitation counselor by the Commission of Rehabilitation Counselors. Grant co-hosts Paranexus Universe Radio each week. He's the assistant executive director of Paranexus and also serves as the vice chairman of the board of directors. That was a mouthful. Grant, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Kelly, it's great to be with you tonight.
Oh, you're a hoot.
No, Doug, it is wonderful to be with you tonight.
Yeah, and it's great to have you. Now, folks, Grant's one of my closest friends, so it's not like the first time we've ever chatted. So, Grant, you don't have to call me Dr. Kelly.
Hey, it's you're entitled. This is your title, and you know it's a real pleasure being on your show tonight.
I was thinking like Lord Doug or Doug, His Holiness the Doug.
A little bit later, once you've officially ascended.
Right. Yeah. And you know, for me, it's probably going to be officially descend. Right.
Yeah. Maybe some of us, I suppose.
Well, even by your own admission, I'm probably going to burn in hell.
Well, we've joked about it. Yeah,
my apostasy. So, Grant, you have been around mental health your whole life. I mean, your whole adult life. I mean, you've been around the block on mental health. I know you have a fascination with transpersonal psychology. You know, let's start off with this. How is it different than typical psychology?
Well, The main difference is it acknowledges the spiritual, the mystical, and what is part of something that's intrinsically human. And I think that what's happened is that I think that it doesn't come to the forefront quite as much in psychology as people would think, but it at the same time, it permeates it in the way that counselors and people will make their approach to communicating with a person effectively to help them in the healing process.
So, you know, transpersonal psychology counseling obviously addresses the spiritual aspect. You know, do you think that's even worth it? I mean, is there any, what significance can a spiritual aspect have on a person's mental health?
Well, I think we have to look at the person as a whole. The whole person, and when you're looking at them, and if a person is having conflicts with their spiritual belief system, and you know, no matter what it is, whether it's Buddhism or whether you're a Wiccan, it doesn't make any difference. If there's an imbalance there, that's going to create a problem for that person, trying to integrate it, because the person, the human body and the psyche, this is my belief, always tries to maintain a state of homeostasis. And when it can't, then that's when you have problems like you kind of talked about in your presentation, you know, where people can, you already kind of alluded to the fact that they can have somatic issues because mm-hmm. they internalize this.
Right. So, you know, and I can attest to that. As I mentioned in my presentation, I've mentioned before, one of the fascinating things about psychology is how my migraines suddenly went away and haven't been back once I resolved the issues I had with my former religion. Once I left it and just basically said, okay, no more, I'm not doing this anymore, this is not working for me, the migraines left. You know, that would imply and really have be compelling evidence for them being somatic, psychosomatic, you know,
uh-huh.
manifestations of stress.
Well, it's exactly. That's it. It's how we cope with it, how we deal with it. Some people might scream and shout. They may, you know, act out in a manner that's not all entirely healthy. Some people may completely suppress that. And we know that when your stress is an actual physiological response, so that when that occurs, there's going to be an outcome.
Right. It's going to come out somewhere.
Yeah, it's going to come out some way, you know. So if a person is having that kind of an issue, or if you're working with a person, you need to take a look at that whole person and see if that may be a complicating factor or a contributing factor as to what's going on with that whole person.
Yeah, absolutely. So transpersonal psychology is taking a holistic approach to to folks, addresses spiritual issues. And one of the things that I appreciate about transpersonal is, you know, we've heard this so many times, you know, somebody with that's having some, let's say, legitimate paranormal issues, whether it's ghosts or aliens or whatever, they go to the psychologist, and instead of really looking at this in a transpersonal way, you know, they're quick to prescribe drugs, you know, the person's or whatever.
Sure, they might clinically say they're psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, would a person who is having stigmata, would they be psychotic?
According to the psychologist or?
Yeah, would a psychologist, they might. They might say
oh, of course
sort
they
of
might.
Pathology there. You know, but yeah, you're absolutely correct. And I think it depends on your perspective, as you point out there. You really, that's taking a very narrow look at whoever you're dealing with or whoever you're trying to help and heal. If you take a narrow perspective, then you're most importantly not helping the person you're supposed to be dealing with. And if it's especially, I think a lot of clinicians, and I'm trying not to be too long-winded here, don't recognize that sometimes. Or it's not that they don't recognize it; it's that they don't recognize it as much as I personally think you should.
I agree, you know, and just to be accurate, a person coming or going to a psychologist, they could have some mental disorders or some mental issues that need to be addressed that uh-huh. are outside of the spiritual. They could.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
It's possible. But a transpersonal psychologist or counselor would be in a position to look at the bigger picture, to look at all of it, to make a better decision.
Or to certainly acknowledge the fact that the importance that that spiritual role plays in a person's life. Now, I've seen it evolve. When I first started in counseling back in the medieval days, we were very hands-off and there were always touchy-feely folks. But, you know, it was pretty much be very contained. Or it was just starting to creep in. And now, I mean, it is recognized. I think a lot of folks take that into consideration because, once again, it's part of the foundation. Because if you go to the very foundations of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, a lot of those founding fathers of that whole theoretical approach to healing people based it on Eastern philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
And so Eastern philosophies are very mystical. And when you address that component, or at least acknowledge it, I think then you can really be much more effective in helping that person.
Here's a question from Vicki in the chat room. How do you make the distinction between hearing spirits versus something like schizophrenia?
Well, there's some very definite characteristics, and it depends on time frames, and there's a lot of different criteria. But there's certain things that go along with it. Sometimes people who have schizophrenia may be very disorganized in their thinking. They may have delusions that are distinctly different than somebody who's having a mystical experience. Although, but by the same token, Vicki, who's to say that what that schizophrenic person is experiencing isn't mystical? It certainly is mystical to them. And there may be a religious component that triggers that whole process too. So I think, in answer to your question, there's criteria that you have to look at that in some cases you can really make the distinction. But one has to be careful too.
And folks, psychology is not like mathematics. Mathematics, you add two numbers, you get a result, and it is what it is. You can't refute it. Psychology is not that way. In fact, it's been called a soft science for a long time because it's an art form. It's not so much a science as it is an art form. And the counselor has to be particularly adept at it. And so when a counselor embraces transpersonal counseling, the spiritual aspect, it adds to their repertoire.
Their bag of tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you want to be as eclectic as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And for your, I know that some of your folks are training to do like pastoral counseling and life coaching. And don't lose sight of the fact that with life coaching, this is just as important that you're not, putting that person in therapy, but be aware of all how these different, each person is multifaceted, and how that particular part, if you're aware of it, you can really help that person. You know, I think, you know, many folks may not be familiar with Carl Rogers, and he did client-centered therapy, which basically put the person in the driver's seat. And for you guys doing life coaching, that your client is in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm. In fact, in the Metaphysics Institute degree program for spiritual counseling and holistic life coaching, there is a video of Carl Rogers, and we talk about that. The course discusses different approaches to this type of thing. And one of the things that I would like to put out there, it's my opinion, not necessarily Grant's, so I'll let him speak for himself, but my opinion is that the vast majority, and I'm not talking about people with mental illness, I'm not including that group, but what we might call generally healthy people, in my opinion, the biggest problem is spiritual issues. And it doesn't have to be religious. Religious is not necessarily the same thing as spiritual. I'm talking about spiritual issues such as self-concept. And one of the things that the degree program teaches spiritual counselors and holistic life coaches is to look at the different aspects of the life leadership paragon: self-acceptance, self-responsibility, respect for free will, and self-completeness. And especially self-concept. In my experience, self-concept plays the major role, or lack of self-concept plays a major role in a lot of different things. What do you think, Grant?
Oh, absolutely, Doug. And you know, if you're doing life coaching, remember, all of us are striving to do what we think is best for ourselves. And we're all striving to be, and I think the best way to look at it is we're all striving to be whole people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, trying to, each person has an image of themselves. Jung referred to it as your persona or your mask that you show to the world. And, you know, that's who you want to be. And so, you know, it's a very interesting process. And I think that your folks that are going to be engaging in forms of counseling, I think if they familiarize themselves, and then the thing about Carl Rogers, you have to remember, up until that time, he really broke the mold, because it was like, you lay down on the couch and you only tell me what I want you to tell me.
Mm-hmm. Freudian.
Right. And then, of course, Carl Rogers said, Carl Rogers was not a doctor, he's a psychologist. He said, let's put the client in the center and see what the client has to say. So for you guys in that life coaching, it's going to, your key is going to be, that client's going to be the center point of what you're doing. And I know that Doug, you can attest to this. But also, you really need to hone your listening skills, because Carl Rogers did a lot of listening. And if you're really interested in what we're talking about with Carl Rogers, he's got a lot of really great techniques that anybody can employ, especially that would be applicable to life coaching.
A couple of questions, or another question in, I guess there's a couple. Does transpersonal psychology consider the mystical elements as well as the spiritual or religious?
Absolutely. And, you know, you have to remember, too, that there's people who have done a lot of research, and a lot of some of the transpersonal research that went on in the 60s was really interesting, because it got into that. It got into the mystical. It got into the farthest end of that spectrum with, like, LSD, and, you know, some of those folks were doing a lot of experimentation. And the name escapes me now, the fellow that was so instrumental in it, but it really got into that era, that side. So it can, you know, it's very, on one side of that equation, it's very diverse, and it is into the mystical.
And another question, is there a trend in psychology toward including mysticism or spirituality?
I think that in my experience, and I'm getting to be an older guy in the field, but I really think that there's always been an element there, and the best people are the ones that embrace it. The ones I think that are the least effective in my personal experience would be the ones that have been very clinical, you know, kind of like somebody who, like, you know, unfortunately some physicians don't listen to people. and I think that the people that I think have been most successful as healers are the ones that have the ability to listen, because I think in your experience you're going to find, and Doug will also back me up on this, listening is the key.
Yeah.
Listening is the key.
So here's a question I think you're going to have an answer to, John, in the chat. How would this relate to parapsychology or paranormal sciences?
Well, that's a very good question, John, and I think that Doug will also. My refocusing on transpersonal psychology came out of some of the experiences we'd had in the field with people who had very powerful belief systems. These people did not manifest any clinical symptomology, but they had a really interesting belief system, and that is what stimulated my interest, because I think there's a parallel there, and I think that if you do anomalous research, you have to recognize how a person's belief system affects their whole perception of the world that surrounds them.
Absolutely. And that kind of gets us into paraanthropology.
Right. And there's also transanthropology, which studies cultural mysticism. And, I mean, some of these folks have, you know, have been doing work with the natives down in South America, where these
Ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca, yeah. Thank you, Doug. And other psychedelics, you know, ketamine and a number of other ones. And those folks have done a lot of research into the cultural beliefs and the cultural belief systems and how that fits in with their belief systems.
I'm gonna echo you on this too. I mean, in talking about parapsychology, paranormal sciences, and transpersonal psychology, transpersonal anthropology, and all of it, in my opinion. Well, you know, in my experience, a good 90% or more of the cases, paranormally related cases, can be explained by natural causes, human psychology, or hoaxing. Most of that is human psychology based on their beliefs, and a lot of them are very different in their beliefs. So everything about transpersonal psychology and counseling has to do with addressing a person's spiritual side. And a lot of these experiences some of these folks can have, so-called paranormal experiences, can be yet another somatic manifestation. Well, it's kind of somatic. It's still outside, but it can be a manifestation of stresses and spiritual issues, cognitive dissonance.
Absolutely. But you know also, Doug, and I know you'll agree with me here too as well, the interest was also stimulated by the fact that even though there have been a number, most of the cases that we've investigated that have not proven to be anomalous in nature or have a paranormal reason, there is still, for me personally, there's been room left over for the mystical.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I see that, I think it's something indigenous to all human beings. I really believe that. I think it's how our brains are hardwired.
Absolutely. Another question, is there a difference in educational, I guess just in education, between psychiatry and psychology?
Well, you have to remember that psychology usually comes from, psychiatry is coming from a medical approach. They're a medical model. And, you know, and there's major differences between psychiatrists and psychologists. The primary difference is that psychiatrists can prescribe medications where psychologists cannot. But nonetheless, there's a big difference.
A psychiatrist is a medical doctor who
continued
to stay in school for a while.
Right, and a psychologist is a little bit less, but still quite a bit. The other difference, too, between a psychiatrist and a psychologist is a lot of psychologists, although they do counseling, they also do a lot of testing. And medical psychiatrists do not do testing.
Interesting. So, transpersonal psychology, dealing with the spiritual aspects of a person, fascinating field. So if you, as one of our listeners, boy, is my tongue tied tonight or what? If you are interested in learning more about spiritual counseling, holistic life coaching, visit the metaphysicsinstitute.org. It's the domain again, metaphysicsinstitute.org. You can see a little bit about our degree programs there. There's so much to this. You know, all of this stuff has to do with consciousness and existence. And I love the metaphysics field because it's so broad. There's so many aspects to it that can be of value to us to help us to live better lives, all the way from understanding how the mind works a little better to utilizing better relationship skills, other practical life skills such as communication and so forth. So, Grant, any closing words on transpersonal psychology?
Well, just remember that if it interests you, take a look at it, because Jung was in there, a lot of the founding fathers. And the other thing to remember about counseling, a very wise counselor told me many years ago, that counseling is 90% art and 10% learned skill.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't agree with that more. Now, one thing that I know that we discussed that we haven't touched on that we wanted to was taking it too far. You know, transpersonal counseling in terms of one's beliefs.
Well, I think what you have to be careful of is don't move. Recognize your boundaries, and the other thing is never put yourself in a position where you think that you're superior to your client or that you have the answers right away. Because if you get yourself in that position, you're going to be throwing a curve. And just remember that whether you're doing life coaching or you're doing pastoral counseling, that people are very complex, very, very complex. And, you know, in order to be a good healer, you need to realize that and realize that people are multifaceted.
And be careful of what you teach them, because if you don't have a grounded basis for what the guidance and counseling you're offering, you know, you can.
Well, you can only
wrong.
Go so far. That's right. Yeah, Doug, I get you. Yeah, and if I miss that point,
nothing.
Yeah, there's a person told me once, you know, like if you have an issue with, if say you were sexually abused, and somebody comes to you and they want to discuss sexual abuse because they've been sexually abused, you might, if you haven't resolved those issues within yourself, you won't be able to help them.
Yep. And you know, there's a lot of psychologists out there who still have unresolved issues.
Well, we all do. We're all human.
Oh, I don't. I have no baggage, Grant.
Doug, we're gonna put you on a pedestal. You are a paragon of psychological virtue.
You're going to put me on a couch, aren't you? All right, Grant.
We're going to get out the tranquilizer gun.
Oh, cool. Drugs. Grant, thanks so much for joining us
today. Hey, it was a pleasure joining you tonight and talking to your students.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Thoroughly did.
Yeah, and we'll have you back sometime and
sure.
Talk about other things. So appreciate that. We appreciate everybody listening to us live on this program or in the archive. Appreciate that a lot. Now, coming up at the top of the hour in just about 10 minutes or so is Dr. Vicki's Psychic Perspective, where she will be taking your calls, offering psychic and spiritual counseling advice. And that's getting close to wrapping it up for us tonight, as far as the regular show goes. Next week, I will have another good topic for you. I haven't determined yet what that topic will be, but I will get it up on the website. If you like what you're hearing, I invite you to join the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science. You can find us on the web at mchschurch.org. If you'd like to learn more about metaphysics, visit metaphysicsinstitute.org. You can get your PhD, degree, and a number of different specializations. That wraps it up. Stay tuned for Dr. Vicki's Psychic Perspective at the top of the hour. This is Doug Kelly encouraging you to listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Have a great week.
This has been Empower the Spirit with Dr. Douglas Kelly. To learn more about the concepts presented in this program, visit mchschurch.com. To take a metaphysics course or to get your metaphysics degree, visit metaphysicsinstitute.com.
Power of the Spirit is a production of the Metaphysical Church of Humanistic Science, Incorporated.
This is Dr. Vicki's Psychic Perspective on the MCHS Educational Network. And now, Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Welcome to Dr. Vicki's Psychic Perspective, Intuitive Life Advice. We're live on the MCHS Educational Network, giving you a venue to ask questions. So feel free to call in. Numbers up there on the screen, 714-459-3973. Of course, we're on chat as well. And I'll be paying attention to the chat, so, you know, watching for your questions. And if I can help you out, I'll certainly do my best. One of the things that we'd hope to do with this show is any unusual experiences that you have, psychic, paranormal, or even any, you know, particular life skills matters or relationship matters that you have, that we can perhaps include a sensitivity or an intuition and maybe give you a hand with that also. One of the things that I like to impart with people, though, and no matter what kind of philosophy or study that you're doing, it has to somehow benefit your life. In other words, how does it make you better as a human being? How does it make you more aware? How do you take those, that knowledge that you're gaining, and bring it into your life? You know, everybody has that little voice. And we always know, especially in hindsight, that it's the right one. The key is to learn how to listen better to that voice. So if you're learning to be more psychic, for instance, you should also be learning about yourself and the things that are in the way of being psychic, in the way of your intuitions. You know, subsequently, this helps in better life management because you're responding differently and you're making different choices. And hopefully, that makes relationships better. So that's part of this program, too. If you have particular questions about relationships, which we're going to get to in a little while, but if you have those kinds of questions, intuition, perhaps past life, any of these dynamics can come into the relationship and help you better establish a new rapport, how to communicate better. So you're learning about yourself, and you're also learning about the world around. Even the smallest things, a lot of people might even take yoga classes or Reiki. A lot of these are very popular venues for people now, relieving stress, meditation, how to get in touch with yourself. But they also have to give benefit to your everyday life. You're incorporating what you're learning into your life. How do you pause and breathe when you're stressed? But are you then considering new ways for managing the situations and not bottling up the frustrations? This is what very often happens. We think in the name of being less stressed, you know, by breathing and pausing, we're actually causing more stress because we're bottling it up. So we want to learn new ways to communicate, to move that energy, so that you can learn how to take stress and make it work for you. One of the questions posed to me in this last week, especially, that lends to this very topic. This woman had asked, "I'm working on becoming more spiritual, and my husband wants nothing to do with it. He says he's not interested. I feel like we're drifting further apart. How can I get him to want to grow and learn?" You know, this is a huge dynamic. Relationship dynamic problem. Very often there's one or the other that may step forward to self-explore, to open their awareness. You can't take people on your journey, but what you can do is represent the journey. You can example that journey. What does happen in relationships that I have viewed in these last 40 years is that when someone decides to take an initiative to grow, to read books, to go to classes, seek counseling perhaps, it threatens the other individual. They don't want to participate because they're afraid that there's something is going to be wrong with them. Rather than seeing that they could be going to something, they shut down and fear about something being taken away. And of course, generally speaking, we can believe that this isn't the case, but it does emotionally happen. So it's not uncommon for one partner to be exploring and the other partner to shut down. One of the things that I recommend in any kind of dynamic or relationship is tell somebody ahead of time what you'd like to talk about. And maybe it's something as simple as your finances and your budget. If somebody's emotionally shutting down, anything that is said to them is going to be a threat. So giving them a heads up, say, geez, do you think we can have coffee maybe on Thursday and talk about blah, 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 blah. And never say more than two things, because that's enough. Of course, it gives somebody time to adjust, to emotionally settle. And, of course, the trust has to be built up. So by the time you get to Thursday coffee, address a couple of things, and you may not get all of the responses that you want, but you have to leave it be where it's a safe zone. It's what I call the safe zone. Then the other one who shut down will start to, oh, it is safe here. If you're going to represent your spiritual journey, you have to do much the same thing, is represent it in a good way so that somebody aspires to you and not shutting down and moving away from you. So these are really important relationship dynamics to keep in mind when we're moving forward and expanding. Not everybody is going to want the journey. Not everyone is interested in the journey. It very often happens in religions where somebody has, you know, found Christianity or Buddhism and the other partner says, no, I'm not interested. Well, then you have to find the other common ground. That's the other places that two people do have a good life together. Because you don't have to believe in the same thing, but you do have to have some fundamental philosophies that you share together. And hopefully that's already established in the relationship. So if what you're exploring continues to make you a better human being, and it expands your mind, and you're exampling a better human being, then you also have to have that respect for free will and not have to take everybody on your ride. I know, sometimes, you know, we get across something that's so exciting, we want to tell everybody, we want to bring everybody on the road and say, this is such a great road, but it's not a great road for everybody. This lends to the next question in particular that I have had posed to me many, many times, but not necessarily in this particular way, about two cultures bringing together and their spirituality somewhat conflicting, but generally it's not the spirituality, it would be then the religious practices or the beliefs of families. And in this particular question, this woman had asked, my fiance and I want to get married soon, but my family is opposed to it because of his religion and his background. Should I break up the relationship? So that's her question. We have to be very, very clear about what her question is. The question was not posed in a way that says, how can I bridge this? She's saying, should I end the relationship? Well, you know, if you're thinking about ending the relationship based on this, you have to ask about your desire. Where's your desire to be? I have known a lot of people from mixed cultures, and really some of the most, I think they're unlikely to survive, but they do survive because the people absolutely adore and love each other. The commonality of them together is greater than the differences of where they came from. And in most cases, and I say this carefully, in most cases in our Western culture, varying religions or cultures can coexist. Now, it's always not always the case around the world, but here, even the most unlikely pairing can survive. And what they've done is over time, people begin to warm up to that union, because that union is bringing something wonderful to everyone. So should you leave the relationship? You know, I can't answer that. You have to decide. There's a bit of a trade-off here, and you have to decide where you're trading up. And can you? Are you strong enough? Do you have courage enough to step into a future and example a good sense of union and spirituality to your family and otherwise? Some people just won't accept it. Absolutely not. You'll be ostracized, cut off from the family. I've seen quite a few of these situations. But then that's your journey. I say that is your particular journey to take. Nobody can tell you what to do. Nobody can say this is right or wrong. You have to follow your heart, follow your spiritual path, and go forward just as you see fit. One of the other questions that I very often get is when you have a member of the family that you don't particularly like. One woman here asked, and I want to be sensitive with these things too, you know, because sometimes there is no reason for disliking someone. She writes, "I have never liked my sister-in-law, but nobody else feels that way. What's wrong with me? Someone said this could be a past life thing." Absolutely. But it also could be that your sister-in-law reminds you of a grade 2 teacher you didn't like very much. It's hard to know where we get our signals crossed. What you can do is not fester this so much as you can step forward and acknowledge that there's something about, if it's not intuitive, because sometimes that'll happen, nonetheless, there's nothing you can do about it. So step forward in acknowledging how you feel and make the very best of things. And, you know, it's not like you have to see somebody all the time, but you make the very best of the relationship. Now, one of the questions that just came up in the chat, what is your take on soulmates and or twin flames? I have addressed this very question many, many times in my life. Twin souls is fascinating to me. And I'll tell you an experience a couple of decades ago. Having met somebody who I later realized was a twin soul, meaning we came from a similar place in the universe, if you will, first activated my ability to be telepathic at long distances. Now, we have to be careful that we somehow don't kind of believe that then means we're soulmates. Very often, twin souls cannot be together. They're equal and opposite. They can do very, very well alone, but they don't necessarily do well in the world together. They're kind of split, but the same. So it's an interesting dynamic. I have seen twin souls married, and it's very volatile, but I've seen them stay together 30, 40 years, but I have no other way to describe it as twinning. It's like they're the same, but, you know, obviously different genders, which makes them opposite, but they're great on each other all the time, but they stay together. Psychology might just say that that's an addiction. You know, that people can be addicted to people just as much as you can be to any other substance. So it's a very touchy thing and it's a feel thing. Generally, you'll get an activation of some kind of telepathy or other psychic experiences that are activated in you to know that that's a twin. Soulmates, you know, Richard Bach, I believed it once, he was the one who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He wrote that he originally, for a long time, believed that everybody was a little bit of his mate. You know, he believed the whole universe being connected, that, you know, whomever he was with was a soulmate because we're all connected. Well, you know, as years went by, he did marry his soulmate, and I can't remember her name off the top, but they're still married and work together. But it turns out that was his best friend in all those many years. And, oh, so he had a whole new take on a soulmate. I'm not sure about it. I think that we can be majority connected with somebody and feel that's a soulmate. I think that we can have a spiritual connection, but that may not mean that you're going to have a physical, emotional, or mental connection. You can meet someone and feel an amazing chemistry with them, but, you know, when you've got the body acting up and emotions acting up, we can think that's a spiritual connection. But is it? You see, it's interesting at all levels to acknowledge the spiritual, mental, emotional, and the physical. And if they all line up and there's a comfort and there's a support to one another, you can be best friends, you can share that connection, then certainly I know a lot of couples saying, you know, we finish each other's sentences. Joseph Campbell, and I love this when I read this in one of his books, said that it's the bliss. He had this bliss with his wife. And they were married, I can't remember how many years, many, many years before she passed. And he said very often he would think a sandwich, and she would go to the kitchen and make him one. He said they hardly spoke in all of their marriage because they had that connection, and they didn't feel the need to clutter it with words. They had an experience in their bliss. Now, if that's not a soulmate, I don't know what is. But there are many explanations for soulmates. It really is up to, I think, the dynamic. We have such a divorce rate now, and people going through many folds of relationships. And I guess it's been talked earlier, we have way more souls on the earth right now. It's kind of a saturation in a way that maybe we're running into a lot of people we've been connected with before. And it's like, oh, well, oh, now it's you. And, oh, and you're with that one for a while. And they go, oh, and it's you. So we have to be careful how we settle into life, stay grounded, know our responsibilities, know where we live, know in our life and how we're going to move with that. Now, I'm not saying people shouldn't leave relationships. I'm just saying that, you know, it should be for good reason. I have seen and attempted to counsel people who are in relationships, been married 10, 20 years, meet someone else and immediately gravitate, because it's, you know, after you've been married for a very long time or been with someone for a very long time, there's a settling into the relationship. You meet someone else and it's euphoric, it's exciting, and it tends to be overwhelming, and you say, yeah, I want that. It's that youthfulness. Something that I remind people of as much as I can and when it's appropriate, that young love, when you have when you're 17 or 18, some younger, older, it only happens once. It's new. The body, the adolescence, the emotions, everything is new. That first love is one time only. People spend their entire lifetimes trying to get that back again. And that's, I think, what they call kind of an addiction in a way. Keep in mind that we change, we grow. Once you've experienced that in that way, it won't happen that way again. But you would have something different. So that first time of that physical, mental, emotional is that first time. That euphoria, it only happens once. Euphoria, of course, can happen in many, take on many forms throughout your life, but it just will be different. And hopefully there's in that maturation, because we're all growing, maturing. So I hope that that really helps. I know it's a little bit long-winded, but soulmates, it really is a perception, and we have to ground ourselves in understanding that there's many more things to a relationship than just saying, oh, we're soulmates. While I think about this, because addictions are so predominant in our culture, I have seen soulmates together, but they can't actually act it out. Yes, that married couple are soulmates. One is an alcoholic, for instance, or a drug addict. But doesn't mean those soulmates have to stay together. Somebody's not participating in the soul experience. They're somewhere else. So as much as it pains us to leave that and to move forward, then sometimes we have to do that. So Is that a question, Dr. Kelly? Dr. Kelly is helping us at the controls today, and so I'm thinking that there was a question. Well, I think I just missed it there. So I'll move on to another question that was posed to me, just moving right over into a completely different area. Somebody was asking me about what they should name their baby. Baby's not born yet. I love this discussion. The father, of course, is hoping for a boy and wants to pass down that name that's been come down through six generations, and the wife is saying no. She has a different name in mind. I say, I understand that there's tradition in families, and I understand that we live in a certain culture, but I'm of the mind, it's my belief, that you don't meet a child until they're born. They'll tell you their name. You know, you can pick out all the names you want. When you meet that little soul hot off the cosmic plane, they're here, and you say, oh, it's some other name. So be careful in not imposing names. So we hope that this couple can negotiate that and just say, can we just wait till the child's born? And maybe you can put that other traditional name in the middle. But a name is very important. That's that imprint at birth. So I'm noticing Shauna in the chat just asked, I'm working on increasing my psychic awareness. Have you found that there are any direct connections to your psychic abilities, or is it a slow-going process? If you're talking about me and you, I think we all evolve at our own rates, Shauna, based on experience, openness. I'll tell you, even as a young child, this is all I wanted to know about, and not about being psychic. My quest was for God, and I'm sincere to say that. I was a very young child saying, this world's not right. They are not supposed to act like that. So I was on a different kind of quest. Experiences in life activate your psychic abilities or your intuitions, but it requires an honesty about who you are and how you want to recreate yourself, I think. So I think for anybody, what I've observed, the general thing that works in opening up your own intuition and your own, as you call it, psychic awareness, is the more you get out of your own way, the more intuitive you're going to be. You're going to learn about that in very many levels, very many ways or avenues. But get out of your own way. So if you're not attached to an outcome, you can see more intuitively. If you're not emotional, you can see it intuitively. So if you can find little skills to work with in yourself, such as, I know I'm emotional right now, I need 10 minutes, and I'm going to come back to this, or this is something I need to sleep on. And then once you let those other things that are in the way, once you let them pass, you'll get a clearer sense of your own intuition or psychic ability. The other thing that very often happens, though, is an expectation of how you're supposed to be psychic. And this is, I think, the second part of why people get confused and very disappointed, disillusioned, is you want to be psychic like someone else. And that just doesn't work. You have to be intuitive in your own way. Some people are more audio. Some people are more visual. Some people have very sensitive nervous systems, for instance. I know somebody who had a lot of anxiety attacks, and every time he had these anxiety attacks, he just get sick and shut down and thinking it was intuition, and it wasn't. So we had a talk about this, and I said, where's the first place things hit you? And, of course, that was the solar plexus. And I said, well, if you can acknowledge that whatever stress is hitting you at your solar plexus, calm that down, breathe, then you'll be able to free flow with your emotions better and your senses will be clearer. In other words, you're not getting all blocked up and stressed. So I think if you find your way, and I really believe that we all get hit by that gut feeling, but whether that's emotional, psychic, or otherwise, but we all get hit by that gut feeling. Nonetheless, if you don't have an expectation of how being psychic works, then you're going to find how your psychic ability works. So you might be somebody who just has to have it in a dream. You might be someone who needs to or is just going to have flashes. My children got used to me, thankfully, because as very young children, I encouraged their intuition to participate. I also, although I think I was, a strict mom, I was also quite liberal. So when I did say to them, no, you can't go out, I had a flash, because that's usually how it happened for me, I'd have a flash, they would believe me. And a couple of times that they didn't, I figure it was moderate enough that they had to learn about trusting mom's flashes. At the same time, I'm learning about my flashes. So it was quite funny when New Year's, they're all, teenagers, and they were going to go out on New Year's. And I said, nope, sorry, guys, shut her down. You're not going out. I just had a flash. Oh, mom. Next thing I know, they're on the phone to their friend. No, I can't go. My mom had a flash. So I was so relieved. By the way, it did turn out there was a huge storm that night. So then we were all very grateful that they were home. But it's a growing process in whatever life experience that you have. Having children will increase your sensitivity, a thousandfold, because you're connected in ways that you can't be with others. So it is that parent thing, and I sometimes think for women, perhaps even more so. I don't like to be gender specific here, but when children come from your body, there's an umbilical cord also, and I don't think that ever leaves. So you're going to have your own abilities develop at your own rates. First of all, know yourself and don't compare yourself. And if you can do those two things, you will grow by leaps and bounds. It's just the way it works. So accept your own. So I hope you're happy with that one, Shauna. Okay, I'm going to go back to my list here. Another question. I think we have enough time here. This woman had written that she has a really bad feeling about going on a trip that's coming up. And everybody thinks she's crazy. She says, am I? I really do want to go on this trip, but I really want to trust my gut feeling. What do I do? Well, this is a huge one. You've got to go by your feelings, but you also have to ask yourself, is there something that really makes me say I subconsciously don't want to go? Because that could be it. So if you're honest with yourself about that, no, I don't see anything subconsciously, unconsciously that would hold me back. And then you have to ask yourself, perhaps isolate the level of stress that you're feeling about the trip. Is it like really bad and you're just getting paranoid? In other words, have you made a small thing into something huge? So you have to stop and ask, what level am I getting fearful? Fear is a huge propeller. So I have experimented enough with myself and others to say, I trust my feeling. I know when I can get in the car, when I can go down the road. I know when I can, when I just can sit still and say, I can't go anywhere right now, but I know when I can leave. So these are the developments. I hope that's been helpful to everybody tonight. We're running out of time. Really enjoyed this time. I'll see you next week, same time, same channel. Thank you, Dr. Kelly, for being such a help. And we're in the archives. Good night, everyone.